Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Across the country, flags at half-mast and heavy hearts. Senator Ted Kennedy loses his battle with cancer. The nation comes together to mourn his loss. From Martha's Vineyard, President Obama spoke of Kennedy's bravery.
His fight has given us the opportunity we were denied when his brothers John and Robert were taken from us. The blessing of time to say thank you and goodbye.
Last night at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library in Boston, thousands of mourners stood in line for hours to pay final respects. Among them, Pat LeBissonnière from Granby, Connecticut.
He's a very, very special person, and just going to miss him greatly, and came to say a fond goodbye to him.
In other news this week, Attorney General Eric Holder's ready to play hardball on torture. That story topped the headlines on Monday. Here's NBC's Brian Williams.
The Obama administration will be investigating the interrogation techniques used by the Bush administration, including torture.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? How are you reflecting on the passing of Senator Ted Kennedy? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine, where she also writes the political blog Swampland. Welcome back, Karen. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Also with us from Washington is Howard Fineman, senior Washington correspondent and columnist for Newsweek. His book, The 13 American Arguments, is now out in paperback. Howard, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Jane.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, welcome to you.
Hello, Jane, Karen, and Howard.
Let me begin with the death of Senator Edward Kennedy, of course, this week. And I'd like to ask each of you right out of the gate here for your general impressions on the outpouring of emotion across this country. Howard Fineman?
Well, Ted Kennedy was one of a kind, but also a prototype. He represents an era of politics that's now gone, and while people are sad over his passing, I think it's also a moment where people are reflecting about the kind of politics and the aims and goals of politics of the era that he represented. So it's more than just the death of Ted Kennedy. There seems to be a sense of a passing of a whole era with his departure.
Karen Tumulty, you agree?
Yes, and I think that it's, you know, so ironic that when Ted Kennedy got into politics back in the early 1960s, he was sort of seen as the lightweight Kennedy brother. And it turned out that he really, in part thanks to the fact that he was given the gift of time, really, I think, probably made a more lasting mark on our country than either of his brothers ever had a chance to. There is not a single major piece of social legislation that you can think of from the past half century that doesn't bear Ted Kennedy's stamp on it in one way or another.
Such a broad reach, Jack Beatty.
Such a broad reach. And, you know, when you look at the totality of it and you take it item by item in education, health care, immigration, children's health, you name it, people are all for those things taken individually. And if you add them all up, what they add up to is domestic liberalism. And yet that is not necessarily – candidates can't run for president calling themselves liberal today, even today. And it goes to me to further show the enduring validity of Samuel Lubell's observation of generation ago that Americans are operationally liberal and ideologically conservative. And the paradigmatic case is the elderly lady who says, "Keep the government out of my Medicare." And Teddy, I think, really stands for that. All the things he did, people are now saying, "Wonderful, great, we love that." If you add them all up, that equals domestic liberalism, the use of the government to increase opportunity for everybody, and not just to sit back and let the hidden hand of the market dictate fortune in life. And yet, such is the ideological impoverishment and I think even cowardice of liberals that they can't even espouse their own creed.
You know, we're hearing the stories about Ted Kennedy, how he helped the little guy. Jack, you mentioned the legislation that, you know, he either wrote or sponsored related to education, immigration, minimum wage, Americans with Disabilities Act. Here is Abina O'Sullivan. She's an Irish-American immigrant, came to the Kennedy Library to offer her condolences. She said she had struggled to get an interview for a green card until Senator Ted Kennedy intervened.
Ted sent a letter to Dublin, which I have a copy signed from him, requesting an interview for me. So within a week, I was in Dublin and I got my green card.
Wow.
And that is the reason I'm in line today.
Howard Fineman, he really was the voice of people on so many issues. But talk about Ted Kennedy, the deal maker. You wrote a piece this week, well, one of several, The Last of the Great Irish Deal Makers. What are we losing with the passing of Senator Kennedy in that manner?
Well, if I can make a couple of references that I think people in New England would know, he was a combination of Dorothy Day and Honey Fitz. He was he believed in the social mission, the Catholic social mission, and there's a lot of Irish in that as well. But he also loved the art of the deal. And one of the reasons that he was able to do what Jack said and what Karen was talking about was that he could both reach for the heart but also the handshake that would make incremental progress toward the goals he was going for. And he did that time and time and time again. I know Karen and I and Jack probably have used to sit in the gallery and watch Ted Kennedy in the back rank of desks there, pounding on the lectern, making the big ideological point in the sweeping gesture. But just as important as what he did behind the scenes after he was done with that booming voice of his, he knew every personality, just as he knew, seemed to know everybody in Massachusetts. And I, as an outsider, am just overwhelmed by the stories of his individual connection to people in Massachusetts. It was that way in the Senate. When the Senate runs at its best, and it doesn't very much anymore, it runs on personal relationships. And Teddy never wrote anybody out, never wrote anybody off. Had a personal relationship and a word and a wink for everybody, and it was those personal relationships that allowed him to do those deals. And I shouldn't speak in ethnic terms, I suppose, but there's some gift of the Irish that he had that the Irish have given to American politics that he summarized and embodied.
And Karen Tumulty, Howard mentions those personal relationships, but he was also willing to incur the wrath of his fellow Democrats to make some of those deals, wasn't he?
He was, and it's important to remember that of the 10 presidents that Teddy Kennedy served in the Senate under, five of them were Republicans, and it was during those eras he continued to make progress toward his goals, and sometimes incrementally, and sometimes he infuriated fellow liberals. For instance, when he collaborated with President Bush on No Child Left Behind, there was a lot about that program that Ted Kennedy ultimately said he came to regret. He didn't think it was funded the way it should have been. But what Republicans said, I was always struck by a quote from Margaret Spellings, who later became the Secretary of Education. She said, what they knew was that if Ted Kennedy gave you his word, he would keep it. He would stick with the deal. There would be no funny business. And that is the kind of trust that he was able to build across the aisle, because more often than not, to get things done, he had to go look for Republican votes. Mm.
Here's President Obama, Karen, speaking on Martha's Vineyard this week when he and his family are vacationing. Here he is speaking on the passing of Senator Kennedy.
The Kennedy name is synonymous with the Democratic Party. And at times, Ted was the target of partisan campaign attacks. But in the United States Senate, I can think of no one who engendered greater respect or affection from members of both sides of the aisle. His seriousness of purpose was perpetually matched by humility, warmth, and good cheer. He could passionately battle others and do so peerlessly on the Senate floor for the causes that he held dear, and yet still maintain warm friendships across party lines. And that's one reason he became not only one of the greatest senators of our time, but one of the most accomplished Americans ever to serve our democracy.
Howard Fineman, that's what Karen was describing there, what the president was speaking of. Tomorrow, President Obama will deliver a eulogy at Senator Kennedy's funeral. Is this an important moment for Obama, too, sort of a passing of the liberal torch, if you will?
Well, I think so, and I think that even members of the Kennedy family, if not especially members of the Kennedy family, viewed Barack Obama as a torchbearer for them. And we reported in the Newsweek book on the campaign that Ethel Kennedy had said precisely that to candidate Obama. You know, the torch has been passed to you, she said. And so I think in that sense, probably personally, Barack Obama feels the weight of that. And I think to draw on the power of the Kennedy legacy for the next generation was not only important to Obama in the campaign, it's obviously important to him now as he tries to pass health care and as he tries, as Jack was saying, to show that there is an ameliorative role for government in American life.
Well, we are talking about the week in the news, the passing of Senator Ted Kennedy, the future of health care without his leadership, and more. With Ted Kennedy gone, who's going to reach across the aisle to find common ground? Last year, Senator Orrin Hatch, a Republican from Utah, wrote a tribute song to his friend Ted Kennedy when Kennedy was diagnosed with a brain tumor. At the time, Hatch said that the refrain called Headed Home meant that Kennedy was coming back to the Senate. The song played here is performed by soul singer Tony Middleton. We're back after a break. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
Just honor him. Honor him. And every fear will be a thing of the past.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news, the death of Senator Kennedy, changing dynamics in the Senate, health care reform, and more. We're talking this hour with Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine, Howard Fineman, senior Washington correspondent and columnist at Newsweek, and our own Jack Beatty. Senator Kennedy made a deathbed appeal to change Massachusetts law to allow the governor in the state to appoint an interim successor in advance of a special election. Democratic Governor Deval Patrick broke his silence and weighed in on this issue on Wednesday.
I think it's a particularly timely request at a time when there are such profoundly important proposals pending in the Congress right now. Massachusetts needs two voices in the United States Senate.
Jack Beatty, what about a successor, a succession plan at this point?
Well, up until 2004, Massachusetts allowed for the governor to appoint an interim senator, should a vacancy occur, until an election could happen. And then, because there was a Republican governor then, and John Kerry, the senator, was the senator running for president, the Democrats in the legislature prevented him from doing that, passed a law, and that was the mistake. I mean, that was an arrant political block. And I think that it's going to look awkward for the legislators to have to turn now on their own words and repeal that law. But it seems to me that there's just a compelling public interest, overwhelming public interest, for them to do that now, especially given the margin in the Senate, where one vote could make the difference. Mm.
Let's go back to Washington for a moment. Karen Tumulty, you wrote a piece for Time this week looking at health care reform after Ted Kennedy. What impact, what effect will his passing have on the prospects for health care reform?
Well, the effect of his absence has been felt all year, in that his committee, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, one of the major panels that has to put forward a bill, was left without his leadership, and I think as a result, it was a lot more difficult for them to come up with a bill. There's an immediate impact in that the Democrats, until Massachusetts does find a successor, don't have the 60 the 60 votes on the Senate floor that it would take to block a filibuster, assuming they could all vote as one block, which is a big assumption. And there's a lot of talk now about how, you know, maybe with Senator Kennedy's passing, his colleagues will decide to put aside their partisan differences and rally together to pass a bill that would pay him tribute. I'm not sure I buy that. I just can't think of another time when politicians have cut their deals and cast their votes with somebody else's legacy in mind. I think it's going to be difficult. And I think that, you know, once the tributes have passed, I think we're right back to this very contentious issue and one, by the way, that is losing some support with the public.
Here's a news conference this week, actually Wednesday, in his home state of Connecticut. Democratic Senator Chris Dodd saying that he will continue his good friend Ted Kennedy's fight in Washington for health care reform.
We need affordable, accessible, quality health care. We all share the same principles. How you get there is complicated, but that's what Senator Kennedy dedicated his life to. I'm dedicated to it. And in his memory, I will do everything I can as long as I can stand in the United States Senate to help us achieve that goal.
And yesterday, in an interview with the CBS Early Show, Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, a close friend and longtime colleague of Senator Kennedy, was asked if he saw Republicans and Democrats getting together to pass legislation for health care reform.
I'd like nothing better than to have a bipartisan bill that will work in the best interests for the American people and get it done. But unfortunately, we've come a long way. They're pushing things that just really would push us towards socialized medicine, and Republicans just can't take that. We could do it, though. We could do it if there were open arms to do it, and if the president would weigh in and work with some of us, I think we could do it. But it's going to have to change dramatically from what they're trying to put through now.
Howard Fineman, can the two parties find a way to work together here? Will Democrats go it alone, push through reforms on their own?
I think the Democrats will probably go it alone, which is one reason why I said at the beginning of the show that Ted Kennedy's death wasn't just about him or about the Kennedys. It was about an era and a way of doing business that we've all covered, but I'm afraid is dying with Ted Kennedy. What Ted Kennedy was able to do was to enunciate the goal passionately in the Kennedy way, and then, as Karen was explaining, reach across the aisle and accept incremental progress. He used his standing as a Kennedy and his bona fides as a liberal as a kind of make weight, you know, in the deal making with the other side. There isn't anybody who can pull off that trick on the Democratic side. There isn't anybody. The fact is that it would be quite an accomplishment for the Senate, for the Congress, to vote for full-on direct federal regulation of the healthcare industry. There really isn't such a thing, amazingly. Teddy could sell that deal, but nobody else can on the Democratic side, so the Democrats are going to try to go for something more, and in the end, they may fail to get anything.
Here's a caller on this point from Boston. Kathy is first up on the line. Kathy, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi. Thank you, Jane. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to you. I'm a physician. I wanted to just briefly make some comments about Senator Kennedy and the issues of health care reform that are being so widely discussed. I did not have the pleasure or honor of working with Senator Kennedy, but I have had many colleagues who did. I remember one in particular who was not politically attuned to Senator Kennedy's liberalism, and after her fellowship with him, was through a program, came back and said she had never worked with anyone who worked so hard and so knowledgeably about health care, and felt that he really was our advocate in Congress. I'd also like to just mention that in the Boston Globe yesterday, there were 5 or 6 pages in tribute to Senator Kennedy, and what struck me most movingly were the stories about his compassion. And if anything, just little stories how he would write notes and call the 9/11 survivors, people who had lost family members, stories about going to visit those young men who had been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. Just one after the other, they sort of took your breath away. And if there is some legacy that I think Senator Kennedy can give us, is that we are at our best as Americans when we tie in to that strong sense of compassion, that strong sense of looking out for each other that he so spoke to, and that if we can keep that forefront, in the health care discussion. We will not fail again.
Kathy, thank you very much for the call. Jack Beatty, would you weigh in here?
I think that's so well said. I'm reminded of a book that Kenny O'Donnell, who was a Robert Kennedy man, wrote about John Kennedy. It was called Johnny, We Hardly Knew Ye. And reading these testaments, you want to say, Teddy, we hardly knew ye. We hardly knew that your ready heart extended to so many people in so many ways. And that's what I think what lives. And it, and I don't know what you think about this, Howard and Karen, but it does strike me as odd that what we just heard from Kathy, compassion, caring for other people, seeing ourselves in other people, putting ourselves in their position, that this rhetoric of moral connection, civic connection, empathy, has not really played such a part in President Obama's pitch for healthcare. Instead, he sounded a lot like Peter Orszag. And when you see Peter Orszag, you think of a calculator. He talks about bending the cost curve and getting... And in fact, the president has more about cutting Medicare, it seems to me, than he has about extending benefits to the people who don't have it. And I just do not understand why the White House has forfeited just the sorts of things Kathy was talking about.
Howard Fineman, President Obama need to channel a little more Ted Kennedy-esque?
Well, I couldn't agree more with Jack. I think the White House was too cute by half here. They thought they could sell health care reform as a cost-cutting measure. There are two problems with that. It's difficult on the facts and the numbers to sell it as a cost-cutting measure. And as Jack points out, you jettison the whole moral underpinning of what you're trying to do in having a decent society covering everybody, giving everybody some access to health care. That's the point, and that's the high ground for the Democrats, one that they've seized in recent years for various reasons, one that I think Obama could use to get back. Obama's Mr. Cool, don't forget, in the campaign. The unflappability, the coolness under pressure was one of the things that he was selling to the people and that the American people really liked. Well, there are other emotions on the palette of politics.
Karen Tumulty, you actually interviewed President Obama recently about health care reform. What was your takeaway as related to what Howard and Jack are speaking of?
Well, this was the week, it was the last week of July, so it was before all this business with the town hall meetings had started and that sort of thing. But the president was actually shockingly frank in the interview at his frustrations, at his own inabilities to frame this message. He acknowledged that he saw the polls getting away from him on this, and he said, I see this, and it should be such an easy case to make, the need so great for this reform, and yet somehow I'm unable to find the right way to frame it. He said, you know, this is turning out to be, as he put it, the greatest challenge of my public life.
Actually, there's a piece that you wrote on this as well, Karen, where you talked about Ted Kennedy's death as it relates to the health care debate. You mentioned Obama as well, but you said that Kennedy's death has actually deprived the Senate of that 60th vote that they need to block a filibuster. And so Kennedy's death has actually made the prospects of for a bill through the Senate much dicier. Is that true?
You know, I think it much dicier, of course, it's pretty dicey to start out with.
Right.
So I'm, you know, at this point, how much we're talking about here, I don't know. But there's one story, I think, too, that's kind of gotten lost in all of this. And that is one that is of very much interest probably to your Massachusetts listeners. And that was the degree to which Ted Kennedy understood the meaning of a moment. And when Mitt Romney decided to try to pass up near universal coverage in Massachusetts, I think that a lot of people missed the collaboration with Ted Kennedy. And Romney once told me, in fact, that had Ted Kennedy turned thumbs down on this idea, he would never have been able to get it done. But instead, these two men who had run against each other at one point within the previous decade, worked together very closely, and the two of them went to Tommy Thompson, the health secretary at the time, got waivers together. At one point, when the Democratic legislature looked like it wasn't going to pass a plan that had Mitt Romney's signature on it, Ted Kennedy, for the first time ever, went to the floor of the Massachusetts legislature and said, "You have got to do this." And so I think that his sense of timing and his sense of moving and grabbing the moment when you've got it is also going to be missed here.
Let's get some other voices here from our callers to Heartland, Vermont. Kenny is on the line. Kenny, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hello, Jane. How are you today?
I'm fine. Go ahead. Thank you.
I'm from New England, grew up in Massachusetts, moved to Vermont in the 80s, and I had always... I've followed politics but since back when John Volpe was the governor. And I'd always kind of thought of Ted Kennedy as a buffoon. But I'll tell you, the things I've heard over the last week or so have just blown my mind. I had no idea of the personal connections he made with people, all throughout New England and the United States. And I have a new respect for both Ted Kennedy and the Kennedy family. Hmm. And, I just heard the other day that they're going to turn Hyannisport into a museum and a learning center, which just incredibly generous. And it's even changed my thinking on the healthcare debate to some degree. I never would have thought I'd be saying what I'm saying right now. I can tell you that. Mm.
Kenny, thanks so much for the call. I appreciate it. Here's another caller from Aiken, South Carolina. Margaret is on the line. Margaret, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I was just listening to the program, and I heard one of your contributors state that we shouldn't talk about his ethnicity when we talk about his accomplishments. And I took a little exception to that, because if I thought if there was a week to celebrate the contributions of Irish Catholic Americans to our social fabric and to our political scene, then this is the week to do it. There's certainly nothing wrong with celebrating the Irishness of Senator Kennedy. I don't think it's bad to say that on the radio.
All right, Margaret, thank you. Howard Fineman, I'll let you respond.
Well, no good deed goes unpunished. I probably wrote one of the, to use another ethnic term, I probably wrote one of the schmaltziest columns about the Irish anybody has put on the internet, because I do feel, that's what I wrote for MSNBC.com, that the Kennedys in general and Teddy in particular embodied a certain way of doing business, both in terms of values and procedure, that is the Irish gift to America. The Irish have been at the core of American politics, I would say, for about 150 years. And Ted Kennedy was the embodiment of the best of it in terms of appealing to that. Now here I'm also going to mention religion, another no-no on the air, to the Catholic social mission, mixed with the Irish gift for gab and ability to do the deal. I mean, that's what Teddy was about. It's taken me an entire lifetime as a political reporter to acquire the basic political sense of your average Irishman in downtown Boston. So I don't know what it is exactly. I've spent my whole life studying it, but Teddy was it.
Let's get in another call here. We've got so many. Tom is on the line from Lexington, Massachusetts. Tom, I've only got about 30 seconds to the break. If you could be brief, sir. Hello.
Yes. Hi, Jane. Hi. I took basic training in Fort Dix, New Jersey in 1951 with Ted Kennedy. He went to Europe after basic, I guess, and I went to Korea. I was 17 at the time. I got hurt over there. I ended up at Walter Reed Army Hospital. Years later, after my discharge, I had a big fight with the VA. I couldn't get my disability. I called Ted Kennedy, and a week later, they had called me in, and I got 100% service-connected disability, which I get today. So that's what Ted did for me.
I appreciate your call and that remembrance, Tom. Thank you. Thank you very much. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we are looking at the week in the news with our weekly news roundtable this hour. Many other stories making headlines this week. A hero's welcome home for South African runner Kater Semenya at the center of a gender uproar.
She is a female. She won. And therefore, we are going to support her.
David Letterman offers his take on Afghanistan's elections.
Hamid Karzai is leading in the election, and he has picked up a lot of swing voters, they said, in the Afghanistan elections because of his No Infidel Left Behind program.
And quarterback Michael Vick took to the field for the first time since his release from jail on dogfighting charges. At the post-game press conference, he said he was a little nervous about how fans would respond to him.
I really didn't know what to expect. Yeah, I was running out there on the field, and I was listening to see what the reaction was going to be, and I was very pleased.
You can join our conversation, listeners. Do you agree that it's time to look at the CIA and torture? Is Ben Bernanke taking the country on the right path with his fiscal policies? Are you feeling confident about Afghanistan's future? You can also follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest this hour, Howard Fineman, senior columnist and correspondent at Newsweek. His book, The 13 American Arguments, is out now in paperback. Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent at Time magazine, where she also writes the political blog Swampland. And our own Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Let's go to Afghanistan now. This week, Admiral Michael Mullen, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, spoke about the war effort in Afghanistan and the American people's support for it. Here he is speaking on Tuesday at the American Legion Convention in Louisville, Kentucky.
I've seen a lot of discussion these days about whether this is a war of choice or a war of necessity. I've seen public opinion polls saying that a majority of Americans don't support the effort at all. And I say, good. Let's have that debate. Let's have that discussion. Let's take a good hard look at this fight we're in, what we're doing, and why we're doing it. I'd rather see us as a nation argue about the war, struggling to get it right, than ignore it.
There are troubling signs everywhere for the administration on this, an election in dispute, fraud charges in the air. President Hamid Karzai in a real fight with U.S. Envoy Richard Holbrooke. It's the deadliest year yet for foreign troops, 300 dead already. The past 2 months are the worst yet for U.S. forces, and a real sense that the U.S. military may need even more soldiers. And, of course, the U.S. public support declining for the war. Howard Fineman, do we have the makings of a real crisis, a real quandary for the Obama administration in Afghanistan?
Well, I think we're there. I think that as public support drops in the United States, as demands for troops there increase, the very objectives of being in Afghanistan are going to be called into question the way the objectives were in Iraq. When Barack Obama ran, he ran to end the war in Iraq, but said that Afghanistan was the place we should really place our focus. That means I think it implied that he thought we had clear objectives and a war to win in Afghanistan, if winning means anything these days. And that's clearly going to be very difficult. I think it's going to be the foreign policy thing that challenges and haunts him all the way through his term.
Jack Beatty, how do you see it? I mean, there was much hope that these elections would demonstrate a sort of stability in Afghanistan. Instead, they pointed out real problems and disturbing new challenges there, didn't they?
They did, and the President Karzai, in order to get through the election, surrounded himself with and favored warlords, war criminals, drug-dealing vice president that he seems to have. Just yesterday, watching the Kennedy cortege, and just the word cortege suddenly and Kennedy's Kennedy death suddenly propelled me back to 1963. And then, too, we had a Democratic president and a strong domestic agenda, unmet needs, get the country moving again. And we were embroiled in a war where no vital American interest was at stake, where we were yoked to a succession of corrupt South Vietnamese governments. And why were we there? I think the Pentagon Papers are clear for domestic political reasons. No president wanted to seem to be the one who lost Vietnam. And what really grieves me most about Barack Obama, whom I greatly respect, is I think domestic politics drives him too. And, you know, there's no American interest at stake in Afghanistan. There never has been. And I think he's sticking there just because to get out would give the Republicans, you lost Afghanistan. Well, we never had it to lose in the first place.
Mm. Karen Tumulty, how do you see things shaking out after the election in Afghanistan?
Well, I think that, you know, that U.S. confidence in President Karzai has not been particularly high. And the real flashpoint is going to be if and when, probably when, Senator McChrystal, who was brought in to sort of shake things up and come up with a new military strategy in Afghanistan, when he does make what everybody expects to be a request for additional troops, this, of course, being on top of the 21,000 additional troops that were brought in March. I mean, that is really, I think, the way this is going to reach the front burner for most Americans who have their doubts about this effort. But at this point, it has not really, I think, reached a crisis point.
Let's move to another issue this week. The Justice Department announced that it will investigate allegations of torture by the CIA. It's a hot-button issue, of course, raising real tensions between those two agencies. The White House, meanwhile, facing dilemmas on how to deal with the war on terror legacy, announced that it will form a new interagency group to handle high-value detainees. Here is Deputy Press Secretary Bill Burton yesterday on the president's new interrogation group.
He thought it was the best way to take down some of the barriers to sharing some of the most important information as it relates to interrogations and detainees in order to use the best scientifically proven methods in order to get the information necessary to keep the American people safe.
Howard Fineman, the torture story made headlines. This is a bold move by Attorney General Eric Holder. President Obama has talked about looking forward. Will you talk about their relationship and where this investigation and the CIA go from here?
Well, I think Barack Obama has a tremendous amount of respect for Eric Holder. And I think that's partly what's driving the situation here. I think the president left it up to the Attorney General to decide whether to pursue anything. And the cautious Attorney General, and he is a cautious guy, took the smallest and yet very significant step of saying, let's bring in a career prosecutor here and have him look at the case. Now, John Durham, the special prosecutor from Connecticut, is really known as a very careful, low-key guy. It's not clear that anybody will be indicted, but the mere fact that Holder was willing to appoint someone like that shows that he's serious, and it does fly in the face of what Obama's rhetoric has been. But I think Barack Obama has respect for the law. He has respect for the institution of the Justice Department and the specific attorney general who's running it. And I think Obama wants to make a point here, which is that the law prevails. And Lord knows, after some of what happened in the previous administrations, I think that's a refreshing thing.
Let me get a caller viewpoint on this. In Melrose, Massachusetts, Nick is on the line. Nick, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, well, thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would just like to point out that, at least from my layperson's perspective, it seems that, you know, from laws that are already in place and treaties, especially, you know, the Geneva Conventions, that we don't have a choice when it comes to investigating these allegations and that a serious allegation must be investigated and prosecuted. And I don't see why it seems to be people seem to think that there's the option of making it a political thing. I don't think there's a choice.
All right, Nick, thank you. Jack Beatty, Nick says this is not a political issue. It's a moral issue.
Well, I agree with him, and I was disappointed with President Obama's early position that we just couldn't afford to look back. We had to look ahead. And, of course, the obvious counter to that was how in heaven's name can we look ahead until we know, you know, what's behind us, until we know what we have done, and until we have accountability for what has been done. And all that, he went out the window because he thought it would get in the way of his domestic agenda. Now it's come back. through this, as Howard says, small door of limited purview for this investigator. But let's not kid ourselves. This limited purview could get bigger. I mean, it could expand. And, you know, there is just something, it's just passing strange to just look into the people who did the torture and not into the people who ordered it and who justified it in law. Those are the guilty parties. And I think that, I just think that some people must be very nervous right now, some people who are in high places in the Bush administration, that this investigation could be a fuse leading to them.
Karen Tumulty, what do you make of Eric Holder's appointment to investigate these allegations?
Well, I think that Jack put his finger on the really sensitive issue here, and it's the issue that I think is driving a lot of the tension right now between the CIA and the Justice Department, two agencies that have been demoralized as a result of a lot of this. The question will ultimately be, it seems to me, if there's any kind of prosecution of people who actually carried out these interrogations, is whether that leads to then the people who authorize them, and beyond that, the people who authorize the policies that authorize the people to authorize them. And, you know, we've got Vice President Cheney out there insisting that these techniques were necessary to bring out information that we needed to avert another terrorist attack. We had a big document dump this week that I think didn't really clarify things very much at all. It really is where this goes.
Let's get to Ben Bernanke and President Obama's decision to nominate him again to a second term as chairman of the Federal Reserve. Bernanke, of course, a Republican appointed first by President George W. Bush. Howard Fineman, what do you make of the reappointment?
Well, I don't think the president had much choice, really, because I think right at this moment the ethic has to be the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm or do no further harm. And I think there's also some wisdom in trying to make Ben Bernanke be the guy to wind back all the extensions of credit that there have been to keep us out of a second Great Depression. And Bernanke did a good job of understanding history there. He's a scholar. His scholarly interest was the Great Depression and the mistakes were made in it. And I think that knowledge served him well. But now we've got a huge overhang of debt and credit out there that he's going to have to deal with. And he's also going to have to deal with the banks. I mean, the Fed got a lot deeper into the weeds of bank regulation than previously, and Bernanke knows how it all was built, and he's going to have to be the one to deal with the consequences.
Jack Beatty, after 7 months of blaming the Bush administration for failed policies with this appointment, I mean, the Obama administration owns this economy now, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed. That's a very good point. Stephen Roach, the chairman of Morgan Stanley, made a very tough point the other day about in the Financial Times about Bernanke. He pointed out, yes, he's, as Howard said, he's done all this aggressive monetary easing with the example of the Depression in mind to help avoid a depression, but he was also, of course, one of the people who helped to bring about this crisis by not intervening when he was the Fed chairman earlier to puncture the bubble while it was expanding, rather than waiting till the point it had collapsed. And in one sentence, Roach said, "It's as if a doctor guilty of malpractice is being given credit for inventing a miracle cure." The malpractice part is, I just think, so clear that this man failed to intervene when he should have. It was partly out of ideology, that Alan Greenspan idea that the markets are all wise and government regulation all wrong. And the entire economy has paid for this. And yet I also agree with Howard that in order to keep confidence in the markets, this man has to be reappointed. But the issue of accountability and his errors of judgment and, I think, ideology, that I'm afraid is not going to be addressed.
Karen Tumulty, Ben Bernanke the right man for the moment or not?
Well, I agree with both Jack and Howard that the administration and the president didn't have much of a choice. I think the thing to watch here going forward is an issue that I think is slipping to the back burner and you're not hearing enough discussion of, which is financial reform. You know, what kind of regulations are going to be put into place to prevent this from happening again? And Ben Bernanke is going to be an extraordinarily important voice on that. And I do think that has sort of slipped off the agenda, and it's very important to do.
Let's get another couple of calls in here if we could before we conclude. From Falling Waters, West Virginia, Brenda has been waiting. Brenda, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Yes, are you there?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. I'd just like to make a comment concerning Mr. Vick.
Okay.
In no way do I condone what he's done, but I think a crippling part of America has forgotten that this man has paid highly for what he did and should be allowed to continue his fortune or job, per se, instead of being constantly ridiculed for what happened.
Mm.
He paid a high price, a much higher price than a lot of people do when they get caught with puppy mills and all that type of incident. They don't pay near the price this man has already paid.
All right, Brenda, thank you. Howard Fineman, Michael Vick, an interesting case study in second chances, no?
Well, as a Redskins fan, I'm outraged that he's going to play for the Eagles.
Okay. Karen,
that's the extent of my comment.
All right, that's enough. Karen, would you weigh in on the caller?
No, I think this is one where I don't have any expertise at all.
Okay. All right, Jack, I'll give you the last word then.
Oh, gosh, I am a dog person. I live with, dogs are a large part of my life, and I would find it hard to express the degree of my repugnance for this man and what he's done. And I do think, I understand what Brenda's saying. He did pay. But, cruelty to animals is a special pathology that seems to argue for just something fundamentally morally wrong with someone. I mean, if you do that to a helpless being, my God, what were you going to, you're almost, you're a danger to society. I know he's paid. I'm just sorry that he's still celebrated because I don't think he should be.
Well, it was a big news week, and we had a terrific panel to discuss it. Many thanks to you all. Howard Fineman, senior Washington correspondent, columnist for Newsweek. Howard, always nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time Magazine. Karen, many thanks to you.
Thanks a lot, Jane.
And Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Have a great weekend, Jack. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation. Listeners, get the On Point podcast at our website, On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.